Accession number 8224, rule number 5.
Mr. O'Riordan, rule 5. I think you were saying that the local nomadic tribesmen were very rarely armed.
We didn't see them. The only time I saw them armed were that they were, I think, occasionally I'd see a small party of one or two, and one man had a shotgun, or not a shotgun, an old muzzle-loading gun. But they were armed, but not the one I'm talking about, the ones that we saw and encountered on the roads. They certainly never pointed any guns at us. They had the arms, such as they had, not as an army, but as for protection of their herds against raiders of other tribes, or when they were out on a mass raid to go and pillage other tribes. There were these two tribes, the Danakil and the Wajirati, up in that desert, and these two were supposed to be always at war with each other, but we didn't encounter any of it. This lot that we saw were obviously out to have a go and at their enemies, I think, but of course I was only then a corporal. I wasn't. There may have been other information. Maybe they were planning to attack us or someone else. I don't know. But anyway, our troop leader and the sergeant thought it would be a good idea to send them away. And so they went. But when I come to think back on it, we did see odd parties of people going. Mostly one or two of them would have these guns for defense of their animals against thieves. I don't believe there were carnivorous animals there, like leopards or hyenas or other things that take domestic cattle. I don't know. It was a barren, it was the hottest place I've ever seen, the most unattractive from the point of view of dwelling in. Unfriendly, hot, and not a smell of desert.
Is there anything you could do to alleviate the...
Well, we used to play cards. To alleviate what?
The conditions and the tedium.
Well, we rigged up shower bars. We got these old petrol debbies and pricked holes in them and fixed them up on the edge of a wall so we could get a shower bath. Of course, we had to be careful of the water. We didn't stay in this place, Sado, which is where we were swapped around fairly frequently. And so we didn't have too much of the worst one. But we played cards, we brewed tea. We didn't see any liquor, I don't suppose, there. And so we went on from day to day, arguing the pitch and toss, I suppose, discussing politics and the world and how we would improve it, sitting miles away from any point at which we could. I can't really remember. I do remember in the earlier days, one of the days of this was this card playing, and we used to sit and play poker. And we spent hours, we seemed to be, under thorn trees, playing a school of poker. We didn't have money, of course, with us. We kept a book. And no one ever, at the end of the day, when the books were reckoned up, nobody owed anyone very much. That was a remarkable thing. But I remember thinking, for the amount of days that I'd spent, or hours, or minutes, in battle, the weeks that I'd spent playing cards and thinking about crossword puzzles and occasionally writing a letter when you were near enough to send it home seemed to be endless. I read through books like Gone with the Wind, How Green Was My Valley, I can't remember, but I remember reading books that people got hold of, that kind of welfare people sent up to us. I read a great many books.
What was the general state of health in the unit? You mentioned the water being questionable.
Well, I don't know if the water was questionable. The water was short. The water was very short supply. You never threw away water until you got some... I mean, dirty water. We had canvas water buckets. And when we were at Arbo, for instance, earlier on, I'm away now from these other places, where the Italians have put in improved water supplies. But when we were camped for long periods in the bush, the water ration went round, you filled your water bottles, you filled the tanks of your cars, and you filled your canvas water bucket, of which each man had one. And when you cleaned your teeth and washed your feet and your hands and your face and shaved, you didn't throw that away until the next chap came by with more water, because you might want it, not for drinking, but for further washing. It was wonderful how refreshing you could feel. I remember, once you had got your feet and your hands and your face washed, it seemed to be important to wash your feet. You felt much fresher, always. Whereas if you'd got into a complete bath and left your feet out, it's possible that you wouldn't have done. And, of course, there were quite large rivers from place to place, and whenever we got to one of these, we went in with the hand grenades and all catching the fish. But when we were at Assab, which is up in southern Eritrea, as I've just said, we were there in a town, a seaport, and we were occupying an Italian barracks. And so we had facilities there. In Assab, there was an ice-making factory. We used to go and get ice. So that wasn't too bad. But I don't ever remember putting any pills in the water to soften the effect of it. I never had any malaria till I got back to Nairobi. I didn't remember hearing anyone getting these tropical diseases of which I'd been warned against when I joined the colonial service, like hookworm or bilharzia or sandfly fever. I kept very well.
What about dysentery and other stomach troubles?
Seemed not to be. We every day we were out in the bush, it was someone's turn to go and dig a trench for latrine purposes, and when you could have three or four chaps sitting along a trench, you push some of the soil in, and when that was full, then you dug another one parallel to it. And the great joke used to be, how long will we be here in this place, and how far can we go with our parallel ditches before we run into another territory?
That was a way of measuring the days.
In a way, not necessarily, but that was just some of the subjects of conversation that used to come up. What are we going to do when we've filled all the area available to us for digging these trenches, parallel trenches for latrines?
Well, you said you were in town in Assab. What was the town like?
Well, it was a seaport town on the Red Sea. Quite a place, but we weren't at liberty to go marching around it. We were occupying a barracks, and there we were. An old actually, the Italian barracks, which another troop of our squadron was in for first bit, had a lot of ammunition stored in it. We don't know whether it was booby-trapped or not, because there was a great explosion there, and five people lost their lives as a result. That was right in August. In August, I remember, because I was acting troop sergeant corporal at another place, and the officer there used to get me to help him decode messages and things. I remember this message coming up, there had been a great explosion, and I think one of the walls was found to beware, we are coming back from the Italians. But whether that was an accidental explosion or a booby trap, time to go off so late, nobody ever knew, but it killed men. And then, of course, we had to move into another building.
So you didn't go out into the town and meet the local
inhabitants? No. We were under very strict discipline to stay where we are. We were there with our armoured cars, and we had to be with them. After all, when we were up in the town doing things, they might have been down doing things to our cars. I mean, we had no other... There were soldiers there, two of the KAR, but they were stationed away from us. They had their own barrack areas.
How long did this...
We used to go and swim in the sea. That was a great social occasion. We'd meet the KAR there swimming at the sea. We had no bathing suits. Just everyone went in black and white and swam about in the sea. And that was our way of running off steam, playing football on the sands and things like that.
How long did this blockade last then?
Well, as far as we're concerned, it lasted less than a year, because we had that fighting at Wadara in May, and I think it was the following month that we started this French Somaliland blockade, June, July or so. And I think that we finally left, a squadron anyway, left Addis Ababa. We travelled via Addis Ababa from our blockade area there in February 1942, just a year after we set off on the advance. I remember that. It was 12 months.
So that was really the end of your...
That was the end of my active war, fighting war.
Yes.
I then went to, like many of our unit, to the Octu, in view of this proposed forthcoming amalgamation, of which I really didn't know much, it didn't concern me, about the amalgamation, I think it was to be of the third, first... No, no, sorry. The 1st, 3rd KAR, the machine gun company of the KAR, machine gun battalion, I beg your pardon, were to amalgamate with the Kenya Armoured Car Regiment, which it then had become already on the 6th of June, and it was then to be Africanized, like the KAR. Other ranks, Africans, sergeants, presumably Europeans, and officers Europeans. That's how the KAR... battalions were organized. So they would want plenty more officers for this greatly expanded armored car regiment, which was stationed at a place called Gilgil in Kenya. So from Gilgil, quite a lot of us went to this Octu at a place called Njoro. And it must have been, I suppose, March, February, March, April, I don't know when. I know that I was to go on an earlier Octu, and the colonel CO sent for me and said he was very disappointed he hadn't been able to send me, but there were only so many places and promises. And so I then, although I was only a corporal, I became sort of headquarters sergeant major, as far as I can remember, hanging around at Gilgil. We were doing a lot of training then, firing on the ranges. I can't remember the details of it greatly, but I remember on returning from Abyssinia to Gilgil camp, waking up on the first morning, thinking I was back in Addis Ababa on account of the noise of shooting, which was the people on the ranges nearby. Well, I went to this Octu, I can't remember when, and it must have been fairly soon. Then, while I was at the Octu, I thought to myself, I don't really wish to go back to the armored car unit, because now the East African forces are going to Burma, the Japanese war. I cannot see them taking the small unit over there when they've got British forces and Indian army with well-trained armoured fighting vehicles. I didn't see any great and immediate future of that. And as I had, as it were, now become accustomed to having come to this war for the purpose of fighting, I thought, well, I will do my fighting from here on in the artillery, which was being greatly expanded. So while at this Octu, I applied to we were all to apply for where we wanted to go. I applied for the East African artillery, which was then being reformed. There had been one East Africa light battery, which I think the Italians captured when they overran British Somaliland in 1940. We had then relied for artillery largely on the Gold Coast. Our lot, the Gold Coast Brigade, had a field battery of small howitzer guns, I think 3.4, as far as I remember. And that was our artillery. The South Africans, of course, had some, but then they left us after the capture of Addis Ababa. They left us to go up to the Western Desert in North Africa. So I thought I'll apply to join this reforming artillery, and I was accepted. I found I had to brush up considerably from what I had learnt in my Oxford days at the OTC, but I was succeeding. I was then a second lieutenant, having come out of the Octu. And while there, I spent a lot of my time at all my time then in the artillery was spent at a place named by the locals, Lark Hill, after the School of Artillery and Salisbury Plain, but I cannot remember what the real name of the place was. It wasn't far from Sika. I cannot remember where, but it was sufficiently known as Lark Hill that name stuck, and I don't remember any other. Well, I spent my time then, mostly, apart from going to lectures in gunnery, etc., training Africans to become gunners, gun drill, and teaching Africans to drive lorries. Quite hair-raising, I think, but somehow I was young and resilient and survived it. I luckily had a certain knowledge of African languages from a short time in the colonial. I'd learnt the language called Chinyanja. I started learning it before I left England, while I was on the Colonial Service special course after leaving Oxford, which we had to learn. And as we had to pass exams in them, these languages in the Colonial Service, I applied myself to wanting to get it learnt and finished with. Well, I didn't really need that while I was in the war in Kenya, because I found I learnt Swahili, a sort of Swahili, without much difficulty. More, so I think it became kitchen Swahili or housewife Swahili. But I learnt enough of that to be able to teach Africans from Uganda to drive lorries and to do gun drill on 25-pounder guns. Well, while I was busy doing that, there came quite a contingent of officers, artillery officers, from Europe, new to East Africa. And the colonel, the CRA, I think is the proper title, the head of artillery in Kenya, as far as I remember, was a Colonel Southey, known as Sam Southey, but of course not to me. I was only a very freshly pipped young one pipper. So he saw that I seemed to have a way of managing the local Africans, especially the domestic servants, etc. So he appointed me to be his sort of personal assistant, but nothing to do with the firing of guns or anything important like that, because he didn't know any words of Swahili and probably thought he would never learn any. So he desired me to be able to explain to his houseboy how to put his bed the right way around and serve his tea and a few other things like that. But I had a very pleasant time there. We talked earlier of riding. Well, there was a man there in the artillery there, and a Rhodesian who'd come there to the School of Artillery, and he was very keen on horses, and they managed to acquire three or four horses, and they had a stables there at this place, which we called Lark Hill. And there were only about three of us interested in riding, he and I and another. And we used to do a lot of riding in the early morning. Off we'd go and exercise the horses. And it was great fun because we'd pass close to giraffes and other animals. And then, of course, that was only leisure time occupation. Well, I hadn't been there very long. It must have been about October, November, perhaps two or three months only, because I had to go. An octo took a long time then. I can't remember how long. But he came, he called for me one day, and he said, I have some bad news. I said, oh, what's that? He said, well, you are recalled by your government to your civilian occupation. You and all others like you were released on the understanding that you were gone there for the East African War, which is now over. And so they're claiming you back on the grounds that there'd been no recruitment to the colonial service. And since the war started, there are people who are getting past retirement age who want to go and have been kept on, and they want the young men back. So he said, of course, I could always see to it that you didn't go if you wish to stay here. And I said, well, sir, I came to the war to fight the enemy, and I fought them, and I don't know how long I could resist the call to go, and I don't know what's going to happen in Japan with the Japanese war, etc. But really, I don't want a career in the army. I have a career, which I've only just done 9 months of before I joined up. So looking at my common sense, I said, you will get plenty of other people like me here at this artillery headquarters. But if I've got to think of my future, I really feel I ought to accept the call and go. Tell you the truth, I think I was getting rather bored with being at Lark Hill, doing a very different job, although it was interesting. I found those Uganda Africans most responsive. So I went back, and in November 1942, just about 2 years and a few months from the time I went up in June 1940, I was back in what is called Civvy Street.
How did you find the transition back into civilian life?
I don't think I found it very difficult. I was then, in September 1941, I had my 26th birthday. So I was young enough to be adaptable. I had lived there in Nyasa land. I loved that life. I had been at an outstation worthy of Sanders of the River's attentions. Sand and palm trees and mountains and elephants and lions and crocodiles and interesting Africans, and I loved it. And the more I could get out on what is commonly called safari, but in our local language had another name, and go to places where nobody had ever been before, the happier I was. And by chance, I was able to get myself back to the station which I'd been before. And my old servant seemed to hear by some bush telegraph that I was back and turned up. And so I was soon back in the job and thoroughly enjoying it. Thoroughly enjoying it. I wasn't out of touch with the army because the army were continually passing through my station, which was on the south end of Lake Nyasa, and there were parties going up by the steamers, the regular lake steamers, up to the north, to Tanganyika, and on beyond, because there was a tremendous amount of policing still going on all through the conquered Italian territories. And garrisons were required there, and of course then they began going to Burma, the East African KAR and Gold Coast and other regiments. So I was continually seeing the army and being reminded of its existence and listening to the news on the wireless, but I don't think I found it difficult, the transition. Because my army career had been checkered insofar as it would be tremendously different and varied from normal. The time riding a mule, doing cavalry drill, and then the armoured cars, and then the blockade of Djibouti, living in those awful deserts, and then coming back to this Oktu with lots of my... We were in a majority, probably, people from our unit, of all the people there. So naturally we got up to sundry mischiefs and pranks and fun and games. So there was a great variety in it. So I really wasn't pushed too much into one groove which I wasn't able to get out of to return to civilian life. I would say that was probably the luck of it.
You mentioned the Ugandans training on 25-pounders. Were they quick to grasp the principles of gun drill?
Well, the principles of gun drill, like any form of drill, when a chap shout whatever it is, you've got certain things you have to do. Once you've got that into them, and once you then had two teams competing each other to be timed quickest, and especially the CO coming round and the sergeant, and the battery sergeant major, I was forgetting the titles, they used to come and watch me and wonder how I managed to get them and time me and challenge me to things. It was, and the Ugandan chaps were keen. They'd come to join up to earn money. They were bored if they were away from home, not being occupied, the same as anybody is. And they were very quick. One or two, naturally, were doltish and tried one's patience.
And what about this business of driving? You said,
well, we had lorry chassis. Not a heavy vehicle, just the driving cab and the engine, and a bare chassis, not with a platform on the back, I think, just open. Anyway, you sat in there with the fellow beside you, and I can't remember really how I did it now, but I suppose we learnt all the tricks that you had to do without the engine being switched on. And then eventually you start the thing moving and you sat beside the fellow with your hand on the wheel and ready to grab whatever was necessary. I can't remember, but you soon learned to say, jam your foot on the clutch in, or if you just shouted the word clutch or brake, he knew which one to put his foot on. Or if you were in grave danger, you said both, or whatever the word was for both, and he jammed them on and you put the thing out of gear and grabbed the handbrake. But it was a wide space, you see. It was probably like a disused airfield or big flat place where there was no danger of running into having any collisions with boulders or houses or trees.
You'd
be able to pull up before you ran out of space.
Were they good drivers once they'd been trained?
I would say they were, but I didn't stay long enough. I didn't stay long enough there to find that out, but they were quick, they were receptive. And they were amusing. They were great fun because they'd all... The awkward one of the squad always got laughed at by the others. So they helped each other along.